Well, hi everyone. Didn't Sarah do an amazing job last week as she talked us through myth number two, that your spouse can complete you? I mean, what a vivid reminder that only Jesus completes us. And when we put that pressure of completing us on an expectation on any other human relationship, it's gonna go badly. So we've arrived at week three, which is our final week of this series. And some of you singles are like, praise God, the torture is over. You know, it's okay. I appreciate those of you who've hung in there with this series. I pray that you've learned some good stuff about God and marriage and relationships in general. And today we're going to look at one final myth. And the myth is marriage is a one-time thing. It's not. Now, this doesn't mean that I believe that if something doesn't work out with your spouse, that you should just move on and ditch them, try again with someone else. That's not what we're talking about here. But it's still true that marriage is not a one-time thing. Let me explain. I recently read this quote by Paul Agnone. He said, one of my mentors used to say that he's been married 7 times to the same woman. I never understood what he meant when I was single, but now I get it. Marriage is not static. It's not a one-size-fits-all pair of jeans that will always wear the exact same. Your relationship will change because people change. And in marriage, you have to be willing to readjust and recommit to new seasons. You see, marriage is not a one-time thing. It's something that we need to recommit to every stage of life. The conditions within your marriage are going to change, but the commitment to your marriage must not. And that can be difficult because our relationships often change when our life changes. And so maybe your job changed, maybe your address changed, maybe your family changed by addition or subtraction. Maybe your appearance has changed, more weight, less hair. Maybe you've had a change in preference or changes in friends or changes in hobbies or interests, changes in affection levels. But if you're alive and in a relationship, you're going to have to walk together through many different changes. And just like people must change and adapt in each different season, so must relationships, especially marriages. And so here's our big idea today. When you're ready to quit, recommit. We're going to start off in a strange Old Testament book today. It's the book of Hosea. You think your marriage has troubles. Wait till you see this one. For the last couple of weeks, we've been saying that the biblical marriage is symbolic of the relationship between Christ and the church. Well, this marriage was literally a living parable about God's covenant love for his people, unlike anything you've seen. So this story is contained deep in the pages of the minor prophets in the Old Testament. It has Howard Stern-like shock value. It's back among all those Star Wars books, Jonah, Micah, Obadiah, Obi-Wan, Habakkuk, Chewbacca, all those. So this book has many lessons for us about God and a few about marriage as well. So the story starts out with a command from God to a prophet named Hosea. God's command was disturbing and a little bit uncomfortable, so we pick it up in Hosea 1, 2, and 3. The Lord said to Hosea, go take for yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. And so he married Gomer. Now, for those of you who are single, I wouldn't recommend this as a starting place. Ladies, don't put this on your Christian Mingle profile page, okay? You're like, where should I start? Well, my name is Gomer, all right? You're doing yourself, you know, no favors right off the bat with that name. And you say, well, let's see, I'm a woman of whoredom, looking to have kids of whoredom. No, this is not good, okay? But God says to Hosea, there she is, she's the one. There's Gomer. Now, incidentally, singles, but half the battle of this whole marriage thing is the selection process. Do not marry someone who doesn't share your values, who doesn't share your faith, who doesn't share your deeply held convictions. You can't think, well, I'm going to change him. He's not surrendered to God yet, but everything else is great. Listen, don't start your marriage at a massive disadvantage. Most other differences can be dealt with, but disagreements on these deeply held beliefs are very hard to overcome. But God knew that Gomer would be unfaithful, and yet he wanted Hosea to marry her anyway. Why? So that Hosea's marriage to Gomer could mirror God's love for you. He loves you and me, even though he knew in advance that we would be unfaithful to him. And so God allows this scenario to play out so that we can understand the mystery of his love and grace. And just like God predicted, Gomer gave birth to 3 children, and then she left Hosea and became a prostitute. Hosea stayed home and he raised the children alone while Gomer sold her body to strangers. Her actions can be summed up in a couple verses from chapter 2, starting in verse 5. for their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink. Verse 8. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold. You can hear the heartbreak. And this scandal became an actual talk of the town scandal. Hosea was a religious man. He was supposed to be God's spokesman. He's a prophet. And look what happened to his wife. Oh, this was juicy news. What goes through a man's mind when his wife treats him as Gomer treated Hosea? He wanted to kill her. He wanted to forgive her. He wanted a divorce. He wanted reconciliation. She shamed him. She melted his heart. This was the person he loved, but he couldn't stand her. And listen, some of you have wrestled with these emotions. Some of you are wrestling right now. What would he do? What would he do faced with a very serious new development? This very serious conflict. Now, before we go too much further, I just have to say that there are times when you need to get out of the relationship and get safe. Some of you are in an abusive and enabling marriage, and you're hearing these words and thinking, oh, the pastor just told me that I should give Jim Bob another chance, even though he abuses me and isn't a danger to our kids. Listen, please, you need to remove yourself from that situation immediately and get safe. And the Bible also makes provision for those who have been sexually betrayed to get out of the marriage. Although this passage is going to remind us that even then, if you can find it in your heart to forgive, forgive. Now, all marriages hit moments of conflict. Thankfully, most aren't as serious as this. It's more stuff like she wants to have a baby, but he says he's not ready. He wants sex far more frequently than she does. He's lax about housework and rarely does his share of the chores until she nags him. Or he wants to raise their children in his faith, but she wants their kids to follow her faith. Or she thinks that he's too critical of their son, but he thinks the boy needs to be toughened up. You know, do any of these sound familiar? They're all examples of conflict that we come into contact with. In fact, there are four categories of marital conflict that couples face. This is from What's in the Bible for Couples by Kathy and Larry Miller. The first category is just annoyances. Everyone has these minor faults. These aren't sins, they're quirks. Your spouse talks too much, or they don't talk enough, or they like socializing with others, or they're more of a hermit. This isn't about sin. It's about a lack of compassion and understanding about who God created your spouse to be. These conflicts would go in the get over it category. There are some things in your marriage that you just need to get over. My wife, Kim, she's an incredible cook. One of the things I'm most thankful for is that our kids have tried every food imaginable, and they've always eaten healthy, amazing meals. But here's the thing. She cooks every single night, and when she's done, it looks like the cooking show Chopped had the Tasmanian devil as one of the contestants, all right? For a while, this bothered me. And could I pick and poke every time it happened to try to get her to change and pick up after? Probably, but it's not worth it. And so guess what? I'm the cleanup guy. We have an agreement. Every morning or every night when the kitchen's a mess, I'm the guy. I'll clean it up. And it has done wonders. I can't begin to tell you what it's done in our marriage. And listen, there are so many annoyances that I bring to the table that she just chooses to get over. Oh, man. I drive too fast sometimes. It drives her crazy. I rinse the dishes with really hot water, wasting precious energy in my wife's eyes. My body shape changes from time to time. I take a different approach with the kids than she would have sometimes. But listen, after 24 years, we've hit a place where we finally said, the little annoyances, they aren't worth the effort and energy. We need to get over it. So, annoyances. But the second source of conflict is preferences. Chances are, during your courtship, you most likely appreciated the differences that complemented you that your partner brought. You liked how your future spouse made friends easily so that you didn't have to pull off the effort. Or while you were dating, it was so cute when he would occasionally call at the last minute and push dinner back a bit because some of the guys at work decided to play a pickup game of softball. You'd say things in the time like, you know, I think that's so cool that you value your friends. Or I love that you're so spontaneous, but 1 month after the honeymoon, it doesn't feel so charming anymore. And when the first time he pulls that stunt, he arrives home to find a note telling him where he can find his dinner. in the trash can with the coffee grounds on top of it, right? And so we have preferences. Like, are we planned or are we spontaneous? And we need to overcome those preferences and work out those preferences in our marriages. It's a little bit harder, but another one that we need to get over and appreciate. The third source of conflict is unintended emotional injury. Now, this is just when someone hurts your feelings, but they didn't intend to, although you might think they did. You can easily fall into the trap of blaming and taking it personally, and each person thinks they're right. But for all of these levels of conflict, and especially this one, communication is so critical. It's important to express your hurt by saying something like, "Listen, I know you didn't intend to hurt me, but here's how I felt." And then just share your feelings. Give your spouse the benefit of the doubt. He loves you. And most of the time, what you think is meant to hurt you probably isn't intended that way. It was most likely just a misunderstanding, and he had inadvertently touched on something maybe that was a wound within you, maybe even something from a long time ago. But it was unintended. The last source of conflict is sin. Now, these are all tough, but this is where it gets really tough. And again, listen, your spouse will sin against you. I promise you. Do you know why? I hate to break this to you, but you married a sinner. And overcoming sin is going to be part of your relationship, whether you like it or not, because your spouse is a sinner, and so are you. And sometimes these sins are going to be grievous. But even still, I pray that most will not be worthy of ending the marriage. But listen, as it relates to all these, the most dangerous kind of conflict in marriage is none of these. But all of them can lead to it. Yes, there's one kind that is like poison to this relationship. The most dangerous kind of conflict is unexpressed conflict. Notice I didn't say unresolved conflict. There are plenty of couples that live happy and healthy marriages with unresolved conflict because they've hit upon a way to deal with this unbudgeable problem so it doesn't overwhelm them. They've learned to put it in perspective, or they have a sense of humor about it. But John Wierick says it this way. He says, it's the unexpressed conflict that is the killer. Unexpressed conflict is a poison that slowly, secretly infiltrates every part of your relationship. And left untouched, unexpressed conflict will turn assumptions into accusations and accusations into evidence. And it's like rendering a verdict when the other person didn't even know court was in session. Couples, you must communicate in the midst of conflict. Silence is a killer. Now, I said a moment ago that there are some instances where the scripture allows for divorce. And in a few rare cases, I have advised people to pursue divorce. But here's the thing. Even in the case of a grievous sin, you don't have to pursue divorce. In fact, we are most like God when we choose to forgive and walk the long road of forgiveness instead of pursuing a quick fix. Now, remember, when you're ready to quit, recommit. That's where Hosea found himself. In Hosea chapter 3, we pick up the story. Gomer's run off and lives now with her lover, her significant other. She's ended the marriage once and for all. She has another man, and fairness said that Hosea could finally get a divorce. In fact, according to the ancient law, fairness said that he could have her stoned. Hosea's free, right? No, wrong. God would not give up on Israel. And he wants Hosea to feel what God feels by not giving up on his own cheating wife. And so during this period of Gomer's unfaithfulness, God tells Hosea to do the unthinkable. It is a command that gives us a picture into the heart of our God. Here's what he tells Hosea in chapter 3, verse 1. He says, "Go show your love to your wife again, though she's loved by another and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods." Now, eventually what happens is Hosea obeys God, and he goes and he tracks down his wife. He finds her, and he actually purchases her back, just like God did for you and I. It's an incredible story. I'd encourage you to read it, the book of Hosea. Because what happened is his wife did not get fairness or even justice. She got grace. And every time I read the story of Hosea and Gomer, or I read some of God's speeches that are contained in this book, they all begin with this sternness and they dissolve into tears. And I marvel at a God who allows himself to endure such humiliation only to continue to forgive. He says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? You see, at the heart of the gospel is a God who deliberately surrenders to this wild, irresistible power of covenant love. And for some of you, listen, the takeaway today has nothing to do with marriage. And it has everything to do with you surrendering to the relentless love of God in your life. You've walked away. You've tried your own way. You've prostituted your will and your desire on lesser gods. You have sought created things rather than your creator, and it has led to emptiness and brokenness. Will you talk to somebody today about it? Today is the day to get yourself right with your loving and long-suffering Father. And so God tells Hosea, go love your wife again. He knows there will be times that it will feel impossible to love, impossible to forgive. There will be words spoken that you can't imagine you'll ever recover from. And take it from me, says God, when you're tempted to quit, recommit. Why did God take this approach? Well, it comes back to the covenant. The reason for God's faithfulness to his people is because his love was based on a covenant. And covenant is one of the most important biblical concepts for understanding God's redemptive relationship with us. Covenants were common in the ancient world. And really, the only remaining modern example that even compares is the covenant of marriage. A covenant is simply a binding relationship based on faithfulness to a solemn vow. And with all covenants, there were these promises and there were obligations. Remember, God promised Abraham land and children and blessing, and he asked for faithful obedience in return. And the whole Bible really is a story of a faithful covenant-keeping God in the face of this relentless wandering of his people. And our modern culture is losing any ability to understand this because a consumer relationship and a covenant relationship are opposites. And as Sarah pointed out last week, most of our relationships are consumeristic. A consumer relationship says, I'll do what I'm supposed to do as long as you keep your end of the deal. And my individual happiness is the goal, and my relationships are simply a means to the end of my own personal satisfaction. But in a covenant, the healthy relationship is the goal, and whatever individual happiness I might achieve along the way is just a bonus as long as the relationship is thriving. And so a covenant relationship says, I'll do what I'm supposed to do, whether you keep your end of the deal or not, because I made a covenant promise. And so in the Old Testament, God made this covenant with his people, Israel. And even though they wandered many times, God would remain faithful. This is what he's trying to teach Hosea. And listen, this may be what he's trying to teach some of you, that when a covenant is entered, it's meant to be kept. In the Old Testament, it was called to cut a covenant because in those days there was no paper to be signed. There were no attorneys to assist. There were no judges to enforce. Back then, a king would cut an animal in half. And as you made your covenant oath, you would walk through the pieces of the animal and pledge your loyalty. Why? Because you were identifying with the dead animal on the ground and you were saying, if I break this covenant, may I be cut in two. May I be killed. That's why we still use phrases like till death do us part in marriage vows. It's our way of saying, I'll die before I violate this sacred covenant. But what happened back then and still happens today is that we make a covenant and then life takes over and we begin to drift and we forget the promises we made and we get distracted by other priorities and we fall into sin and we get apathetic toward the relationship. And when that happens, we need to come back around and recommit to the covenant. Marriage is not a one-time thing, remember? You have to commit to it again and again to make it work. And so that through the whole Old Testament, you'll see regular accounts of covenant renewal assemblies and ceremonies. When the children of Israel, typically following periods of apostasy or times of crisis, they are assembled by a leader to publicly rededicate themselves to the conditions of the covenant. And so you see it in Joshua 8 and Joshua 24, that this leader, Joshua, calling the people together for renewal at Shechem. And in 2 Kings, when Josiah, after they discovered the book of the law, he gathered the people back together in the temple for a time of rededication. And in Ezra and Nehemiah 9 and 10, when Ezra recommitted those who have been exiled in a foreign land to the laws of the Mosaic covenant, again and again we see the faithfulness of God and the broken and sinfulness of people coming back and saying, we need to start again. We need to recommit. You see, being in a committed relationship doesn't just happen once. Just like in marriage, it needs to happen over and over again. At each new stage, with each new sin, with each new conflict, we need to come back around and say, I'm in it till the end. I'm in it for the long haul. God told Hosea, go show your love to your wife again. Remember back in week one, we said that the husband's key contribution to the marriage covenant is to love his wife and the wife to respect her husband. But the husband to love his wife as Christ loves the church. And what God's telling Hosea here is, go keep the covenant. Show love to your wife again. This is far from easy. But there are a couple practical keys that we need to understand in order to be covenant keepers within our marriage. And so let's talk about these two practical keys to covenant. It's what Hosea was drawing on as God commanded him. The first practical key is forgiveness is based on grace and not paybacks. So often we wait to forgive until we perceive that our spouse has paid us back, until they've said the magic words or done enough in our minds to make up for the damage that they have done to us. But covenant forgiveness is not based on paybacks, it's based on grace. Remember the parable Jesus told in Matthew 18. Pastor John preached on it a few weeks ago. Let's take a moment and apply it to marriage. Peter comes to Jesus and says, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times? And Peter thinks that he's being really generous here. But Jesus is about to take the lid off of how much grace and mercy we're supposed to show our spouse. Husbands and wives, listen up. Jesus says, I don't say to you seven times, but 77 times. Or a lot of scholars think that it's 70 times 7 or 490. This verbal construct was a phrase which meant the highest number that you can think of, infinity. And all Jesus is doing is saying, you forgive as many times as it takes. And just to make sure Peter doesn't think that on incident number 491, he can choke the guy out, he goes to tell this parable. He says, there's this servant who owes this king an incredible amount of money, and so much that the king considered selling him and his wife and his kids and all of their possessions just to have some semblance of a payment for his debt. But the man comes to the king and he falls to his knees and he begs and he pleads the king to forgive the debt. And you know what? The king does. The Bible says it this way. He says, out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But that same servant, he walks away from having his whole debt forgiven and he finds a fellow servant who owes him $5 and he asks for payment. The other servant couldn't pay him. And so that servant falls to his knees in the same way and he begs and he pleads for forgiveness. But there's no forgiveness. In fact, the man who had just been forgiven has this other servant thrown into jail until he can repay his $5 debt. And in the end, the king finds out and he confronts this man and he says, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And the king has him thrown in jail until his debt can be repaid, which is never. And Jesus' point is clear here to those who insist on living by paybacks. Spouses, listen up. He's saying, how dare you choke someone else out when God had mercy on you? How dare you ask God for patience and then you demand payback? How dare you bow your knee to God and still stand over your husband or wife and say, pay me what you owe me? Romans 13:8 says, owe no one anything except to love one another. And so you came into your relationship with God with a huge debt yourself. You had a big bill and you received from God forgiveness for your sins. And it's not because you paid him back. It's because he had pity on you, as this verse says. And because of his great mercy on you, a sinner, you have to extend mercy to your husband, to your wife. In fact, you'd better uncross your angry, folded arms and throw them around that person who needs your forgiveness and say, I'm sorry I've imprisoned you with my unforgiveness. I refuse to hold your debts against you when God hasn't held my debts against me. You see, in a covenant relationship, guys, forgiveness isn't based on paybacks. It's not based on that person earning it. It's based on the grace that you receive first from God. Because he forgives, we must also forgive. The second practical key to covenant keeping is this. Love is based on commitment, not convenience. Remember, marriage is a covenant and it's not a contract. Contracts are built on mutual distrust. If I will, you will. Contracts are built to find loopholes. But marriage is a covenant and it takes deep commitment. And just look at the Bible and you'll see that sometimes keeping your commitment, it's not convenient. If marriages are going to make it, it's going to take commitment. It's going to take looking at each other and declaring, I wasn't playing when I said in sickness and in health. I wasn't playing when I said for better or for worse. People don't believe in commitment anymore. We hook up, we shack up, we try it out. But listen, the ones that work, the true covenant relationships, I promise you one thing, they're going to be inconvenient. The reason you're here today is because God remained committed to his covenant, and it was not convenient for God at every turn. It wasn't convenient for Jesus to leave the comforts of heaven and come down to this dark world to be born in a barn, but he had a covenant to keep. It wasn't convenient for Jesus to heal people who would turn on him at a moment's notice. It wasn't convenient for Jesus to invest in a group of guys, some of whom would betray him in the most painful way. It wasn't convenient for him to pray in the garden and sweat drops of blood while his friends slept like babies, but he had a covenant to keep. It wasn't convenient when everyone mocked him, when they beat him, when they pulled his beard from his face, when they drove spears into his side. It wasn't convenient when they spit on the face of the radiance of God's glory, when they put spikes through his hands and feet. You are here today because you have a covenant-keeping, promise-keeping, oath-making God. And he said, I swear I will be with you to the end of the age. And you say, my spouse is just so hard to love. Well, you're pretty hard to love your own self. And just look at the length that Jesus went for you. You see, it's not about convenience. Marriage is a commitment. And sometimes you need to hang on simply because a covenant demands it. Covenants are different kinds of things. And we see through the teachings of Jesus, and we see through the example of God, and we see through the story of Hosea that covenants are made to be kept. And when you come to that conflict or that fight or that sin or that annoyance or that moment of unfaithfulness and you're tempted to quit, recommit. For those of you that are single or just dating, or maybe you're widowed, we're going to have a special time of prayer and renewal for you and your relationship for Christ in just a moment. As this song plays in just a second, I want to ask you to consider in your singleness one step that you need to take in your covenant relationship with God. There are also some of you who are here today without your spouse. And for some, it's painful that he or she didn't join you today. We want you to have a time of prayer and renewal too. So please use this time to consider a step that you need to take in your own marriage covenant or your relationship with God. And if you're here today married, both spouses are here. We're going to provide a little time for you at the end to renew your love for each other publicly right after this song plays. Now, I know there's some of you who are married and you're not willing to do that today. I promise we're not going to try to do this in such a way to embarrass you or to single you out. We don't want you to be disingenuous or feel coerced. And so there's no shame in saying, hey, I'm not ready to do this today. I would ask that you just use this song as an opportunity to whisper back and forth with your spouse and say, hey, are you game for doing this? Do you want to recommit to this next chapter? And if you're not up for it, we're going to have you stand up just with everyone else and silently pray with everyone else so that you don't feel embarrassed or singled out. But for many of you today, we're going to renew some covenant vows. When the time comes, we're going to ask you to stand up and look at each other in the eyes and say words that maybe you haven't said to each other in a long time. But remember, marriage is not a one-time thing. It's something that needs to be renewed and recommitted to on a regular basis. And I pray that today would be that day for some of you. And here's what we're going to declare to each other, these three declarations of renewal. We're going to say, again, I commit to you. Remember, because this is about commitment and not convenience. We're going to say, again, I forgive you based on God's grace alone and not based on you paying me back for any hurt. And again, I love you in all your brokenness. You know, if you've been married for at least one day, you already know that your spouse is not perfect. all those dreams of perfection have fallen quickly away. And for some, the years have revealed some dark stuff. You know that person better than anyone else. You've seen their brokenness. And if you will hang in there and hang on to the covenant, God will use that person to make you more like himself. It doesn't take perfection, guys. It only takes commitment. And maybe we're not supposed to make each other whole and perfect. Maybe we're supposed to just be broken together. So let's consider the message of this song. And then we're going to have a time of recommitment together.